22nd November, 73.
Yeah, the Orphic, yeah. Vanderhulst Muller at Orphic was in 54. So right. In between there, I spent 8-9 months in South Africa.
I see.
But somehow or another, I had already gotten enough interest, and of course I'd worked closely with Zort on that paper, that I was kept very much informed by Oort in letters, and he visited South Africa once and so on, mm-hmm. so that I gave lectures, colloquia in several places about the 21 centimeter line galactic structure in South Africa.
I see.
In fact, I wrote an article in the monthly notices of the South African Astronomical Society.
I see.
Which is a mimeographed pamphlet, sort of thing, on the spiral structure of the galaxy, as found for the 21 centimeter. And that was in the summer or fall of 52.
Mm-hmm.
So by then, that was already quite a bit known. But because before this Muller and article, there were a few smaller things, particularly in the Academy of Sciences, which already had spiral arms in it.
It was one observatory.
And in fact, then on the way back from South Africa, I stopped off for a day or two in Cambridge, at Ryle's place,
mm-hmm.
and talked with them, in essence informed them about everything that was going on. So somehow or another, I must have been kept quite well informed by the Leiden group about what was going on. Mainly by Oort, I would say.
And when you went back, you jumped right in?
And the guy who did most of the initial observing in Kootwijk was a man named Walter Big Muller, whose name you may have heard.
No, I haven't.
No. He did a lot of the initial observing. He was also been a graduate student. I think he was an undergraduate at the time. Anyway, he did a tremendous amount of the initial observing. And when I came back from South Africa in November, the end of November 52, things were... all the data, I think, for the initial paper had been taken. And I still remember that at one stage, and that must have been in the spring of 53, that data had to be reduced properly, and all the... You may have heard that story already.
I think it's in your paper, in the New York...
I see. All the graduate students were, in essence, collected by Vanderhulst, and I can still see us sitting in the collegiate hall in the lecture hall.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had a stack of chart recorders, and they were reduced, and more things were done with them. That must have been in the spring of 53.
Yeah. How many people were doing this?
I'm sure there were about six or seven of us or so sitting there, plus perhaps a few Rekenaars, a few calculated people. It was quite a large group, and as a result, the thing got done in no time at all, like 3 days or so. That was, in other words, the reduction of the data to such a point that then I think Vanderhulst took it over again and started working with it from there on. However, we had already started, the receiver had been considerably improved, and we had already started the observations in Kootwijk for the big survey, which were done in a very systematic fashion. Again, let me see where this original profile. Between July and June, Muller had developed the system to a fine art, so that then these profiles came out. And in November 53, I came back from South Africa, so that's when I started getting involved in that. I think I more or less did nothing else anymore. One of the first things we did then was this rotation curve business together with Quay. It was also graduate student.
What has happened to him, by the way? Where?
He's at Leiden.
He's still at Leiden?
Sure.
I didn't know that.
He's an expert on W. Ursa Majoris stars.
I see.
I mean, it was the only thing in radio astronomy he ever did.
I see.
And I think that also came out of that session in the lecture room where we reduced all those data. I mean, he sort of got interested and was asked, would you take that on? So he took it on. So he and I went out and observed pieces of profile, and he did most of the reduction, and somehow or another, we then finally came up with the final paper.
Well, now, what about the actual observing at Kotvik for the...
Now, that's a whole story in itself. That was great fun. I always remember that as something exciting. I don't know why, because it must have been god-awful boring, but I was young enough, I guess, to always find it exciting, because I would spend weeks and weeks there. I was in the hotel. There was a hotel right next door, Hotel Radio Kotvik, which was... And I was, in essence, just living in that hotel. I mean, when I came in the middle of the night, I'd go to the refrigerator and get myself some milk and whatnot. I remember once the hotelier saying, now look, don't put the milk in our beer glass. That ruins the beer glass for good. But for that, Meneer Swaak, or one of these people, but I think it was Meneer Swaak, had calculated these extensive tables, which must still be around somewhere in Leiden, for each, let me think, how did it go? There were tables in the galactic plane for a start of azimuth and elevation.
For each LMB, for each day.
Not for each day. As a function of sidereal time, of course. But all the scans in the central regions of the galaxy were made as constant declination scans. And I think that was done because our initial set of tables contained only values for the galactic plane.
Yeah.
And of course, constant declination scans, you simply move the time.
Right.
You add 5 minutes to the time, and you have...
You move along the plane, yeah.
Yeah, you move along the plane. Now that I come to think of it, they were constant declination scans, so we didn't move at all. That's right, it was only later that we got sophisticated. Right, we had azimuth and elevation tables for the galactic plane only, so we would set at the azimuth and elevation for that particular longitude 10 minutes beforehand, and then just let the plane drift through during that time. So we did not have to follow a point in the sky as we did.
Right. So you were integrating only with the natural drift rate. I mean, they were drift scans, really. You weren't following the source at all. Well, this is probably described in the procedure is probably described in there.
Anyway, later on, I'm suddenly trying to think what the integration time, what the damn integration time was of that, of those things. All right.
Okay, so in fact,
sure,
you did follow a point for 3 hours.
Yeah, we did follow a point for 3 hours, but then we could use the same tables by just moving the time coordinate by 5 minutes for the next point on that constant declination circle.
Right.
That's how it was.
Right.
But then in the outer parts, after we'd done that first thing, of course, more had been calculated, and we gained more experience, and we decided to do it at neat intervals of 2.5 degrees in galactic latitude and galactic longitude. And therefore we had a set of tables for each point as a function of time.
Right.
And what you did, that Würzburg had a motor to drive it in
azimuth.
Yeah, in fact it had two motors. It had a motor to drive it in elevation also. But they were fast motors, and then there was a little crank sticking out of the wall to
There were fine adjustments?
For fine adjustments, yeah. And there was a little crank sticking out of the floor. And those cranks, the one at the floor, let's say, was here, the one at the wall was here,
yeah.
And you looked outside, and there was a...
An indicator
on the big circle, and you looked through the floor, there was a hole, and there was an indicator on the azimuth circle. So you stood there, and you usually had to crank about three or four times here, three or four times there, and you had the new coordinate. We did that every 2.5 minutes. So you suddenly were busy all the time. Mm-hmm. And then every now and again, you'd write the frequency by one of those spikes that appeared every 10 kilohertz, mm-hmm. as the one channel receiver slowly but surely swept through the line.
Right. But how accurate was this pointing, actually? Just roughly, I mean, the beam was a degree or something?
No, the beam was 2.5 degrees.
2.5 degrees.
2.5. So every 2.5 minutes was better than the tenths of the beam width.
Okay.
I mean, there was no doubt about it.
No problem at all.
I'm trying to think whether I calibrated, I think I did, on point sources. I made a number of calibrations of the positional accuracy of the telescope.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I certainly did that.
Yeah.
Because I also have a paper somewhere, an initial survey with that same telescope of the continuum radiation at 21 centimeter. I made a continuum survey with that.
Is this in BAN?
Yeah, it's also in BAN. There's an article in 56 in the BAN called Search for Polarization of the Crab Nebula and Cassay at 22 centimeters wavelength.
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, I found the polarization of the Crab Nebula, but didn't believe it, so I said, it is certainly less than 1.5%. Well, it was 1.2% or so. I mean, it was clearly there at the right position angle, but it was...
But you didn't believe it.
If I had sat there for another 2 days, I would have had it. Alas, that's one of those things, you know.
Is this in the paper, these, what you just told me?
No, it isn't in the... Well, yeah, what I just told you is in the paper.
Yeah.
The result was negative.
I know, but from the paper, can you see that
you can see that I had it.
I see.
Right. Continuous radiation from the direction of the galactic center. It was also in 56. Where the heck is that article about... distribution of radiation along the galactic plane.
Continuum.
Yeah. That material was used by Schmidt at the time to reduce his data for the central parts of the galactic plane. We then split the data up into two parts, Martin Schmidt the central part and the outer part. In any case, I think all that was to figure out who actually did the pointing calibration, but I'm sure I did the pointing calibration, because there's a 56 paper on galactic center and a 56 paper on the polarization, and there's a 54 paper where it was Quaid, Muller and Westerhout. So I must have done all the pointing calibrations.
Who else was observing out there, students like you, for this survey?
I don't really know.
You did the bulk of it.
Yeah. Because it took a year, more than a year, to collect all that data. So I certainly didn't do the bulk of it. But I think there were a whole lot of students going out regularly to.
It was just rotating for a week or so.
It was usually 2 weeks at a time.
Well, what about the reduction of this data now after it had all been gathered tediously over a year?
No, it was more, I think it was more gathered tediously over 2 years.
2 years.
Sort of. Yeah.
Did this reduction proceed in the same sort of line everyone up in the room? And
no, the reduction was done, in essence, by myself and Martin Schmidt, with the help of several computing aids, both the old and experienced guys as well as some young girls that we had at home. We would tease to tears every now and again. I remember one of them once threw an ashtray at our heads, which burst into one of these big, good, fat glass ashtrays, which burst into a thousand pieces against the wall, and then ran screaming out of the room. I mean, heck, there were all these young graduate students teasing this poor girl who was sitting there measuring things with a ruler the whole blinking day. That was a pretty horrendous job.
Yeah.
I mean, so what it amounted to was reading off the data from the chart recorders,
right,
and tabulating them and fitting a baseline and subtracting it, and well, the whole procedure is given in that paper, of course, and then Mr. Swark made all the second differences. I remember that, still remember that. I, at one stage I had, I was always after trying to get people interested in what they were doing, so I'd given Mr. Swark all sorts of, he was close to retirement, almost 64, 65, and he'd been at the observatory since the age of 12. So I would give him nice graphs to make and explain to him exactly what it was, you know. And then at one stage I went to him with this enormous job of for 600 profiles, each consisting of 150 points or so, to make second differences. And I didn't quite know how to give that to him, but he had to do it. We had decided he was the man who could do that. And after a day he came back. He says, "Meneer Westerhout, that, I like that job. All those graphs, I didn't understand. But I really like this job." Oh boy, was I happy.
Yeah.
He was really happy there. And he was really one of these really good old-fashioned people, you know. He would make his little, when the numbers became too large, he couldn't do it by heart anymore. But do you think he used observatory paper? No, he used pieces of wrapping paper to make his little calculations on. Thousands of little pieces of brown wrapping paper were all spread around his desk every evening, which he brought from home.
Who was directing all of this now? Was it really Ort that was coordinating all of the work that's in that BAN in 57?
No, that's what I was doing it. With the help of Van der Holst. No, Ort was relatively little involved other than in the scientific discussion of the matter. No, I was more... No, these were two... These were basically, you could say, two pieces of thesis research, one by Schmidt and one by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Even though neither of us bothered to make it a thesis into a thesis, but...
It could well have been,
yeah, right. Yeah. But I was, at that stage, of course, interested in the new telescope was beginning to come up, the Dwingeloo telescope. And Schmidt got more and more interested in modeling of the galaxy.
That was his thesis, finally, the mass model?
The mass model.
And yours was the continuum survey.
Right. Which is sort of paper number 12 or 13 in the list.
But now, before we get off to Dwingeloo stuff, well, is there anything more about this? I mean, you haven't really talked about the scientific interpretation of that. I mean, was that sort of straightforward? I mean, it was the same sort of principles that were used in the 54 paper. It was just more data and more complete.
It was very much more complete. And in particular, of course, there was a lot of discussion on the accuracy of the data. The very complete way in which we tried to remove the smoothing due to cloud velocities and so on, defense of that, big story about accuracies.
And I forgot now, this sort of thing wasn't going into in the 54 paper? Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
No, this didn't go into the 54 paper at all. No, the 54 paper only has a relatively short section on the
Well, maybe
reduction.
Maybe a way I should ask it is, other than the completeness, which enabled you to get a obviously a more complete picture, were there fundamentally different things in this paper from the 54 paper?
Yes. Fundamentally different things in that there was very much more detail available. And therefore this paper here, particularly in the conclusions, it has interpretation and discussion, there's description of the spiral arms, each of the spiral arms. There's a very extensive, not a very extensive, but there is a discussion about random motions, which everybody overlooks.
Mm-hmm.
The first discussion about random motions, namely the fact that you see, when you look at the galactic anticenter, you see that there is there are features at 20 or 30 kilometers per second, and I figured out, supposing there would be that same feature at longitude 150 or 140, how much wrong would we place the spiral arm? And it came out as 2 kiloparsec, and I mentioned it here.
Yeah.
And it was only very much later that people started coming up with that idea again, that those positions of those spiral arms weren't accurate at all, even though it said so right in the initial paper.
Yeah.
And I think the reason is, of course, because this was too long a paper for people in general to read and absorb.
Yeah.
You like old Dutch papers.
You think that was a tactical mistake, perhaps, to...
Maybe it was. A lot of things there that sort of faded into the background because there's such an enormous amount of work. Another basic new thing was, of course, the Z distribution.
That's right.
The first paper was only along the galactic plane. We determined the Z distribution. We determined the position of the galactic plane. And... or rather, I did all that. Schmidt used the data in trying to get the near and the far points in the inner parts separated.
Right.
But I didn't collect it a whole lot together. I missed the fact that in the southern hemisphere, I mean, I mentioned very precisely that in the northern hemisphere, quite clearly, the plane curves up tremendously. In fact, there's a picture in there that shows it, but I missed the fact that in the southern hemisphere it actually turns down. As a result, it's Kerr and Burke in the same year.
Right, but the data was available.
Not really. But there must have been... And when you look at it, you see it going up here, and you see it going down here.
Yeah.
So the data, what one could have...
You could have speculated that.
Speculated
it looked like it was
that.
Going down, even from the coat plate.
But it was in that same year, Kerr and Burke, who both, to whom the discovery of that effect is attributed, even though it's quite clearly there and described in the paper.
What about the reality of all these spiral features? Did you believe in them too much then? I mean, looking back on it now, or did you really have the right idea that that, or not the right idea, but more modern ideas that that this needs to be taken not too seriously?
Well, since I knew how they were arrived at, I was pretty convinced that the contour map. This one here,
The colored one,
the colored one, was pretty good. In other words, that given the model, the mass model of the galaxy and so on, you knew that if the mass model wasn't quite correct, because at that time already Schmidt was busy on his PhD thesis, so we knew that the tail of the mass model, particularly for the outer parts, could flip up and down somewhat, which would move things in and out.
You mean by changing the rotation curve?
By changing the rotation curve. I think I have a remark somewhere that such things as these splits in the spiral arm might not be actual splits, but might be simply due to random motions. So I certainly was aware already at that stage that it was certainly not necessarily on the small scale a true representation of the distribution of neutral hydrogen. On the large scale, there was of course no doubt about it. I mean, when things connect that beautifully. And then of course this so-called artist's impression was quite a major effort. I mean, it always looks, I think we spent a month on that. Just day and night trying to figure out which is the best representation of that, looking at all this contour map here is a projection on the galactic plane. No, sorry, it's not a projection, it's the maximum densities in the Z direction. But of course you would have a spiral arm going up here,
right,
and another one going sort of underneath it, and it's only the underneath one which has more intensity that would be shown on here.
Yeah.
And realizing that there was much more in all these charts which represent the real data than there was in this map, I decided to make that one up.
We're talking about plate A and B in the 57 group of papers.
That is so that really tried to represent everything there was, and these bifurcations and so on, you still see in more modern things, mm-hmm. just as much as you saw them in those old data.
So in other words, you don't think you overinterpreted the distribution of the hydrogen, looking back on it now?
No, there was no overinterpreting in the sense that I simply represented what I had observed.
You think it may have been taken that way by other people, in believing every little feature too much? I mean,
yes.
Obviously this is a very striking, mm-hmm. even in color,
mm-hmm.
So that people might take that too much at face value as what you would really see if you were,
yes.
outside the galaxy.
Yeah, people were taking that far too much at face value, and in particular, they did not read the paper that went with the picture, which made comments about random peculiar motions of clouds or cloud complexes which could change position of things rather drastically. And of course, objects like this here, these beautiful smooth spiral arms that you see, I'm thinking of the Sagittarius arm and the enormous Coutum arm, sort of in the range of 4, 5, and 6 kiloparsec. I know exactly how we got those features. We had some gas left over, and we decided to distribute it evenly among the circle where it was probably located.
I see.
And it says so in the Schmidt paper, but
I see.
People then later on don't realize that anymore.
Yeah.
That's why later on, and even now, you see no detailed maps of the center or part of the galaxy.
Right.
People have never redone the Schmidt work, and the same work that Kerr did on the other side. Simply because it's too damn hard, and we'll have to do a lot more modeling before we're able to do it. That's why you see the Sagittarius arm on all these maps always as a dotted thing and another dotted thing for the enormous Coutum arm, while in the outside people draw all these little line and small connections, because it's much more unambiguous. It's quite clear that there are two major features going around here, but you can't say at all where to place them.
Right, exactly how they go. Okay, well, then this was published in 57.
Yeah, let me...
Okay.
Yeah. Let me say one more thing about Kotwijk before we step off Kotwijk. You may have that piece of information already, but Muller told me once, and I certainly believe him, that he blames a good deal of the success of his receiver on the fact that he was working right in the middle of the Dutch transmitting station. And as a result, he had to shield every single part of his receiver so unbelievably well that all the problems that people got later, who built 21-centimeter line receivers and got birdies and all sorts of things and all sorts of interactions and always problems, Muller never had. From the beginning, he never had them, because every piece of equipment had to be completely encapsulated, or you would get something. And he was sitting right in the middle of a transmitting station.
Right.
Funny that
Yeah, he did mention that to me, right?
Wouldn't think of it. He mentioned that to you, okay.
Yeah, well, that's...
I remember one instance where one of the engineers said, now I'll show you something neat. That stage, the Dutch still had their long wave transmitting broadcast, mm-hmm. at 1800 meters or something like that. There were these enormous antenna masts with great big guy wires and enormous numbers of insulators on it. And this was sort of a wet day, so he said, now come along to the bottom of one of those guy wires.
Yeah.
A great big screwdriver in his hand, and he held it by the guy wires, and there came a huge big spark jumping over,
right.
And the spark was beautifully modulated. So in the crackling, you heard the music of Radio Hilversum. And it was in that environment,
right, that
we were observing all that stuff. Yes, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, he did mention that to me, but I did. He didn't mention though that you say other people did have a lot of trouble with birdies and so forth in the early days.
Oh yes.
Now that I didn't realize.
Right. Oh, Ewan's receiver. Ewan later then built a receiver for Bach, and Harvard. And always had trouble with that thing. Always things here, there, and everywhere. And anybody who built receivers in those early days had problems with signals leaking through.
Mm-hmm.
For line spectral line receivers.
Yeah.
I mean, after all, this was the first spectral line receiver.
Right.
I mean, if you have a birdie in a continuum receiver, all right, it doesn't matter. Right. Your total noise goes up a little bit.
Yeah.
No, in those early days there were lots of problems of that kind with the spectral line receivers.
Okay. Well, okay, so about this time Dwingeloo dish came into operation. I guess it was actually 1956, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When it came, was commissioned?
Yeah, that's right.
And did you immediately begin working with that?
Have you interviewed Hooghout on that?
No, I haven't. I don't
because
think
he was, of course,
yeah,
completely in charge of that.
Of the building of it.
Building.
Yeah, I'm afraid I won't get to him, at least this time anyway.
Because he'll certainly have a tremendous amount to say about all the various problems. That I wasn't very much involved in the design of that thing at all. For one thing, I had my hands full with this stuff, of course. It wasn't until... we actually started getting receivers ready for it, that I started getting involved. And the first time we got involved was the two occultations of the Grand Nebula in November of 1955, where Seeger at that stage had developed a 400 megahertz receiver, very good 400 megahertz receiver. And this was more or less the first time, and I do not recall who thought of the idea that the Grand Nebula was going to be occulted by the Moon. I have a strong feeling it originated in Leiden, but I can hardly believe that because I can't imagine who would have originated that. It must have been one of the clever chaps in Cambridge or so. In any case, that opportunity was grabbed. The telescope in for the first occultation, which was the beginning of November, this is the Dwingeloo telescope now, November 55, could not move yet in elevation.
Mm-hmm.
It could already move with the fast motor in azimuth, but not yet in elevation. It was sitting vertically. The manufacturer must have done that for us, put it in the vertical position. The occultation took place just before the Crab Nebula rose, just after the Crab Nebula rose, just before it set, either one or the other. So it was relatively close to the horizon. So the manufacturer set the telescope for us with a big boom, metal boom that stuck out to the edge of the telescope, and thereby tightened it at an elevation of 7 degrees.
I see.
That's where the telescope sat. The
at your request.
Our request, the
occultation was going to be. Yeah.
Right. And the occultation, however, of course, took an hour. So how do you follow? Well, we followed by moving the focus, the big pole on which the antenna was mounted, up and down. All that I calibrated beforehand, and I was entirely responsible for that. In other words, I had to calibrate the motion in azimuth, I had to calibrate the telescope in azimuth, right. And I had to calibrate the telescope in elevation. The elevation one was rather remarkable, one of the inventions that has also made me famous in the early days of Green Bank, namely the wire, that idiotic boom on which the feed was hanging,
yeah.
Was sitting at the end. The top guy wire was the one with which you could lower the boom and then get to the feed.
Right.
So we used that lowering mechanism. So that simply, if you think of the dish here, and here's the apex of the dish, so this wire, there's a box here, the apex, this wire came down here,
yeah.
And then somehow or another there was a crank here. So I attached to that wire a thin little wire that went down here, over a little pulley there, because it was in the way somehow or another, and down there again, and on here, had a little pointer, and I had a long ruler here, and that was the elevation scale, and that elevation scale had to be calibrated.
Right.
Similarly, in azimuth, we looked at all the various drawings, and we found that there was one little axle coming up out of the azimuth shaft, which actually went around as the telescope, yeah. Went around, we could get at. We were not allowed to disturb the manufacturer.
Right.
So we settled on that axle, and we said, now how are we going to read off that axle? So I went to Raunen, the nearest town, and bought an alarm clock. We dug into the alarm clock and attached it with tape and baling wire onto that axle, and somehow or another attached the things that set the hands,
yeah.
To that axle. So when the telescope rotated, the alarm clock hands would go around, ticking off the hours and the minutes. And I calibrated that in degrees of azimuth. That was an unbelievable system. So during that first occultation, and after having done all that and made all those calibrations, for which I think we only had 2 days, because we weren't on and off again,
yeah.
Because we were disturbing
right.
These guys. Having made all those calibrations, we were actually able to point at the Grand Nebula and follow the Grand Nebula during the entire occultation. One guy standing upstairs with a table in his hand.
Right.
Which I had also calculated, and one guy downstairs with a table in his hand, cranking in azimuth,
right.
And cranking in elevation. The second occultation, the elevation
was it
fast
motors. A month or two later?
No, it was 1 month later.
Yeah.
28 days later, in fact. The elevation fast motors worked, and we decided not to lower the boom anymore, but actually use the elevation thing. Moreover, it was at a different altitude.
Yeah.
However, we still needed the calibration. This time we needed the calibration of the elevation angle. So somehow, on some member, I made markers to calibrate the elevation angle, and we fed up from directly out of the box in which the elevation motors were located, a little cable out was a push button,
yeah.
And you give, there was a lot of training involved in that, because you could give it only a tiny little burst, you know, it only going,
right.
And then 20 seconds later, another little burst of power to make it jump up,
right.
These little pieces, to go up. That was the second occultation.
And
that was approximately half a year before the telescope officially finished.
Yeah, you did these observations. And that was Seeger and you and...
That was Seeger and myself.
And that's all?
Yeah.
And what were the results?
The results were two beautiful occultation curves of the Grand Nebula, indicating that the center of the Grand Nebula... Because the moon, of course, on those two occultations went through it in different
right.
Angles, so we could really almost get a two-dimensional picture.
Mm-hmm.
And indicating that the radio center of the crab coincided to within within a fraction, small fraction of a minute of arc,
yeah,
with the what was then assumed to be the central double star,
right,
one of which we now know as the pulsar,
right.
And Van Herk measured to unbelievable accuracy the position of the central double star, which had never been done before. In other words, he took a polymer plate or so to the plate measuring machine and measured and applied all the corrections and attached it to the fundamental catalogs that were then in existence.
Right.
So the position of that double star in that particular paper is in essence the standard position of the center of the Grand Nebula. I don't think anybody's done it with that sort of accuracy anymore.
And that's published in BAN.
That's also in the BAN article, right.
That's very interesting. I haven't heard about that.
That was in 56. Published in 56. Yeah, we published it pretty soon afterwards because we were all very excited, of course, about the whole thing. And then it was absolutely unbelievable that that came off.
That it all worked, yeah.
Both occultations.
So then the dish came into proper use in 57, or 56.
Right. In May of 56 or so, the Queen had to dedicate it, and I'm sure you've heard
that. Oh, she came out?
Yeah, I haven't heard that story.
I know about her coming to Westerbork, but I didn't know she had gone
to Westerbork. Oh, yeah, she officially dedicated the telescope, and it was all beautifully rigged, and the last few weeks, we were there night and day, Hochhaut and I mainly again. At that stage, I got involved because there was a lot of astronomy to be done. The pilot, the automatic pilot, which I presume is still there, yes, probably still sitting there in Ringelo. Have you ever seen that thing?
Not knowing that I have anyway. Or
I mean, it's the big gray thing that's sitting in a box on the floor of the in the observing cabin, which looks a little bit like a telescope. It's two axes.
Yeah, I don't remember, but it was 4 years ago that I was there. I haven't been there since I've been in Holland. I mean, in the telescope itself.
Right.
You know, I've been in the labs.
I'm sure it's still sitting there. I think they're now after seeing on the computer. So that was a masterly invention of Hochhaut's, I think. Hochhaut's together with Rademachers. It was an analog computer converting Wright's engine declination into azimuth and elevation. Simply mounted, in essence, like a little telescope.
Oh, yeah.
Two sets of
right. There was a similar thing on the NRL 50 foot.
Right, except that that one was unbelievably sloppy. The internal accuracy, all that, the internal accuracy of the pilot, you will find in my thesis paper. Mm-hmm. I calibrated that whole thing first internally, and then its connection with the telescope.
Anyway, back to the, that's right.
I'm trying to, Muller at that stage had moved to Dwingelo and installed his receiver in there. And the day came nearer and nearer, and we couldn't point that telescope, and there was all sorts of things wrong.
But why does this really matter for the Queen? I mean, she wouldn't know.
Well, but, you know, the thing had to work. Somehow or another, the thing had to work. In fact, the first line profile was obtained the day before the official dedication, showing that the receiver worked, which was rather important.
It was and a line receiver, the first one that was on there, besides
from
your occultation. Yeah.
No, that occultation thing was a 400 megahertz.
Right,
I mean,
besides
thing.
From the occultation.
Yeah. Yeah, then the line receiver went up.
Right.
And we had a recorder outside. There was a table, a recorder on it, and a big, great, big, gold-looking